On this week's 51%, an author talks about her book, Girls and Sex.
You know, I think that young women today, the girls that I talked to, felt entitled to engage in sexual behavior, but they didn't necessarily feel entitled to enjoy it.
A teen reflects upon her mother's breast cancer diagnosis, and we visit a roller derby team in New York. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. So we got a bum, bum, bum. Yeah, we're up, 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 up. Feeling hot, hot, hot. Feeling hot, hot, hot. Peggy Orenstein is an author and journalist whose most recent book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, invited Orenstein to her studio in San Francisco to discuss the new book, including why girls feel such pressure to be hot and how sex is like a pizza.
Birds do it. Bees do it. But we definitely don't want to think about our parents doing it, or especially our teens doing it. But eventually, do it they will. For her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, Peggy Orenstein set out to find out what exactly the it is these days and how porn, pop culture, and popular attitudes about sex influence the way our girls make their way in the world. The book is written for parents, but I intentionally left it lying around my house in a place where it might be easily picked up by my own daughters. Welcome to the program, Peggy.
Thank you for having me.
How are girls' attitudes towards sex different today than they were 20 or 30 years ago when their parents, say us, were growing up?
You know, I actually have two answers for that. One is, if there's not a difference, why isn't there? But the other is that I think there is, you know, I think that young women today, the girls that I talked to, felt entitled to engage in sexual behavior, but they didn't necessarily feel entitled to enjoy it. And so there was sort of a disconnect between this kind of performance of sexiness, performance of hot, which is foisted on girls in which they feel so pressured, you know, to live up to, and this complete and utter silence about their actual developing sexuality and what was going on in their bodies.
As far as the way girls are dressing and behaving, this notion of hotness and sexy,
yeah,
you cover a lot of ground in the book about, are they doing it for themselves?
Right.
You know, are they doing it for in their own pleasure? Or are they doing it for other people?
And who knows, right? How can you tell minute to minute, second to second,
right,
which it is? So one young woman that I talked to showed me a picture of herself in, you know, a little crop top and a miniskirt and the sky high heels getting, you know, ready for a party. And she said, I'm proud of my body and I never feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothing. And I said, okay, let's talk more about that. And then a few minutes later, she said, a year ago, she wouldn't have worn that outfit because, as she put it, some jerky boys would have called, she was 25 pounds heavier. And she said, some jerky boys would have called me the fat girl. And that would have been bad for my mental health. So then you have to ask, like, you know, who gets to be proud of which body, under what circumstances, and really how liberating is it when the threat of ridicule lurks right around the corner? And so girls were constantly shifting back and forth between, you know, I'm doing this for myself, I'm a subject, and oh my God, I'm being objectified, and I'm doing this for myself, and I don't like the comments I'm getting. And it, they switch back and forth, and it was so complicated. I mean, that's part of why I call it. And they were sold this idea, whereas I think, you know, baby boom parents, Generation X parents, this whole notion of hot, which is, you know, so superficial and so commercial and such a narrow vision, you know, of what attractive and sexy is, baby boom parents and Generation X parents, I think, would have pushed back against it as self-objectification. But again, you know, for young women, they're sold that as a form of confidence and power. So it's very confusing and hard to figure out where you stand in it.
Right. Or the whole grunge movement, right? With the
right,
baggy jeans and the flannel shirts and everything's kind of covered up.
Or the riot girl,
yeah,
movement, right? When you're writing slut across your stomach or whatever, you know, young women were doing in the 90s. It's a very different idea. And, you know, there's this constant conversation. Just yesterday or the day before, there was a new series of Calvin Klein ads. Did you see those with Khloe Kardashian?
Yes, the Take a Peek.
Like what I do in my Calvins. I pulse in my Calvins, all right? And they're these very sexualized images, but the idea is that the women chose to do it, so then it's okay. But again, you know, which bodies get to make that choice? Under which circumstances did they get to make that choice? And with somebody like Kim Kardashian, you know, there's always this discussion, is she a feminist? Is she a slut, right? Like, those are the only two options.
Right.
And what Lisa Wade, who's a sociologist at Occidental, says is, you know, she gave me this great term, which was patriarchal bargain, is when a woman takes the roles and rules that typically disadvantage women and takes the power, all the power she can from those roles by embracing them, but without changing them. So what Kim Kardashian has done is make a brilliant patriarchal bargain. She has taken all the power she can from roles that disadvantage women. She has totally embraced them, and she's changed nothing by doing so.
But
she's gotten very rich.
And then what is she going to do when her looks fall apart, her body falls apart,
right?
You know, and the cameras are still following her
or
around.
Or if she didn't have, you know, whatever. Yes. And so it's like, it's again, this idea that, you know, it's not a feminist choice. I don't know what slut means anyway, so I can't say it's, you know, that's just ridiculous. So it's just a patriarchal bargain.
Well, what about in schools? Do you think that it's really incumbent upon school systems to teach kids about sex?
Well, yeah. I mean, in California, we've just taken a really big step forward with the affirmative consent law that mandates that we have to teach affirmative consent in our schools now.
What does that mean?
We have to teach kids now about consent. We have to teach them that only yes means yes, and that they have to get that yes from their partners, and we have to have comprehensive sex education. Now, that said, so only 23 states mandate sex education at all in this country. Only 13 mandate that it be medically accurate. And one of those is California, but it wasn't until the spring of, I'm trying to think if it was 2014 or 2015, that the city of Clovis was finally found in violation of that law for teaching their high school students that an unmarried woman who has sex is like a dirty old shoe, and teaching them to chant anti-gay slogans. So that was going out in our state.
That was the curriculum.
That was the curriculum in our state.
Well, I'm still wrestling with the question of what the role is, though,
of schools,
because we don't teach etiquette. You know, I mean, no. what are the other...
But I think, you know, we have recognized that sex education is something in one way or another that schools ought to teach for many, many years. And it's just, it's obviously political. And I don't think it, you know, means that parents don't have responsibility, but it is ground zero, honestly, of the war against women. And it has been since the 1960s. Before that, sex education was not political. It was taught in the context of a family life course. It was taught as something that you did after marriage. And it was taught as something positive. And it was only when the specter of sex outside of marriage, girls having sex outside of marriage, teenagers having sex outside of marriage, became a reality, that it became a political battle, and that the effort to stop that from happening and to control young women's sexuality became such a big issue, and that the abstinence-only education advocates began coalescing and creating and pushing for and winning, obviously, you know, clearly, at the expense of kids, because we know that abstinence-only education results in higher rates of disease and vastly higher rates of pregnancy, a.k.a. Bristol Palin, Exhibit 1.
So back to the idea of talking about it.
Yep.
Being a positive thing.
Being a positive thing. And so because of that, I ended the book in a sex education classroom and in a coeducational sex educational classroom where kids, because obviously boys are a big part of this conversation, where kids were working these ideas out together. And again, a lot of it was about decision making. A lot of it was about understanding what assertiveness was. A lot of it was applying some of the ideas that you apply to the rest of your curriculum, you know, in your personal life, revising, reflecting, redrafting. And in that classroom, which is run by a teacher named Karis Dennison, who lives in Marin and consults in classes throughout the Bay Area, one of my favorite things was this boy who raised his hand and said, you know, that baseball metaphor we use for sex? I just thought about that. You know, in baseball, there's winners and there's losers. So who's the loser supposed to be in sex? And I thought, that shift, you know, it's small, but it's profound. And it's a foundation so that that boy will be able to go into his relationships more as a partner and less as an adversary, and not see girls' limits as a challenge to overcome, which is what that baseball metaphor encourages. So, you know, again, it's about ethics, responsibility, reciprocity, enjoyment. And a conversation like that, like, what about that baseball metaphor? It's not really a threatening conversation, you know? That's a great conversation for kids to have.
I never thought about that.
I know. That's, and so, she really, you know, what she replaces it with is the Al Vernacchio, who's a Pennsylvania educator, talks about sex as a pizza.
Okay, tell me more.
That's my favorite metaphor. So, okay, sex is a pizza. If you decide if you're hungry, you know, baseball has a season. You do it in season, whether you want to do it or not, you know, like prom, right? You decide if you're hungry. You and your partner go out. You decide if you want pizza. You go out to pizza. Maybe you want, you negotiate the toppings. Maybe you want mushrooms. I want pepperoni. So we go halvesies. Or maybe we have mushrooms this time, pepperoni next time. Or if I keep insisting on pepperoni and you keep kosher, you're not going to go out to pizza with me anymore, right? Because I'm a jerk. If I try to shove pizza down your throat, who does that? Who would try to shove pizza down your throat? You know, it's all about this shared, in pizza, we are invested in our partner's pleasure as well as our own. Our partner having a good time as well as ourselves. We want it to be an enjoyable, collaborative experience. And that's what sexuality should be, not this race for a to a goal. And, you know, what I'll say to young people is who really is, and we've been talking primarily about heterosexual relationships here, but, you know, who is really more experienced? The person who kisses their partner for 3 hours and experiments with, you know, erotic tension and sensuality, or the person who gets drunk, hooks up with a random, unloads their virginity because they want to get it over with before they go to college? Really, who's the experienced person?
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you hoping will change as a result of this book, Girls and Sex?
Well, I hope that it will launch the kind of conversations. You know what I think about is, I think about the food movement, and I think about the ways that, like, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, whatever, who had ever heard of a free-range chicken, you know?
Yeah.
Who had ever heard of, you know, organic food was like this weird thing that hippies ate or something. And the changes that we've seen in food justice have really come about as a result of conversations that were launched from some books, from Michael Pollan's work, from Eric Schlosser's work, right? You know, I frame this book, there's a phrase that Sarah McLellan, who's a psychologist at University of Michigan, coined called intimate justice. And that's like, just like, you know, who does the dishes or who vacuums the rug in your home is a political act as well as a personal act, right? A political decision. Sex, too, brings up these issues of personal power, of mental health, of violence, of economic disparity. And you have to ask, who is entitled to engage in experience? Who is entitled to enjoy it? Who's the primary beneficiary of that experience? How each partner defines good enough? You know, and those are really tricky questions. I would like to hear adult women asking those questions. But I think that for girls, you know, I don't want girls' early experience to be something they have to get over. And I want us to be in a culture where girls and boys are engaged in these conversations themselves, where we're engaged in those conversations with them, and where they are truly balancing responsibility and joy.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Peggy Orenstein, author of Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. She was speaking with Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW. Now we hear from a teenager who reflects upon the time when her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. Here's Katie Wilhelm.
Cancer changes everything. My mom was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 12 years old. When I found out, a rush of emotions flooded through my mind. I felt shock, sadness, anger. Most of all, I felt fear. Fear that I could lose her, that I wouldn't be able to see her every day, that I couldn't tell her how much I love her. I don't think I fully realized then how much my mom's breast cancer diagnosis affected my life and how I see my mom. Now that I'm 16 and my mom has been cancer-free for almost 4 years, I wanted to explore my own feelings that I couldn't comprehend when I was younger and try to understand how my mom felt when she was going through her treatment. When my mom told my brothers and me that she had breast cancer, I don't think I fully understood what that meant. At age 12, I didn't really know what cancer was. I knew my grandpa had had it. I knew that it could kill people, but I never really took in the fact that it could kill my mom. I thought my mom was invincible. Up until then, I had no doubt that my mom would be a constant in my life, always there for me. Suddenly, I faced the very real possibility that I could lose her.
Telling you and your brothers that I had breast cancer was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Looking back on it, I didn't want you to know how scared I really was. When I finally gathered up the courage to tell you, I completely broke down in tears. I wish I could have told you in a calmer, more reassuring voice, like I usually do as a mom, but in that situation, there's just no easy way to tell your kids.
A lot of my memories of this time are foggy. Maybe that's my way of dealing with a difficult time. One thing I will never forget was my mom shaving her head before starting chemotherapy. Believe it or not, I never actually saw her bald. I remember she always wore a wig or a hat or a scarf and a nightcap to bed. I don't think she wanted us to see her without any hair. When I was 12, I didn't realize how big this change was for my mom. Without hair, it becomes a symbol of sickness. I now see how much courage my mom had. I wanted to know why my mom chose to shave her hair before it fell out.
I remember being given the choice to shave my head or wait for my hair to fall out in clumps. I decided to shave my head because it made me feel better to lose my hair on my terms. I felt like I could control at least one aspect of this cancer diagnosis.
Through 4 months of chemotherapy, families in our community brought us meals. Back then I saw it as just another meal, but now I realize how much more meaning those meals held. Each family labored over each meal with love, just because we were going through a difficult time. Looking back, I now have a much better understanding of how important it is to surround yourself with good friends who will help you in your time of need, and in turn, how important it is to help others when they need it. I never really realized how much of an impact that a small act of kindness can have on someone.
I really underestimated the power of other people's kindness and allowing that kindness into your life to give you support. Those meals sort of became a light every time that there was darkness.
I remember one specific moment when it really hit me that my mom had breast cancer. It was the first day of 7th grade, and I had to have a syllabus signed. My mom had scheduled her mastectomy for that day, and I had to explain to my teacher that I couldn't get it signed. The teacher asked why, and I said she had cancer. I distinctly remember my eyes welling up, and I could barely keep my tears from falling. It was the first time I had cried about my mom's cancer since her diagnosis. Up until then, looking back on it, she had worked really hard to keep our lives as normal as possible.
I felt like with the help of friends and family, you and your brother's lives were largely able to go on as normal. But as I was in the hospital, I realized that the best helpers in the world couldn't make up for the fact that I wasn't there for you on the first day of school, like I had been in every other year before that. And that was really hard on me, just as it was hard on you.
I had always taken my mom for granted before she was diagnosed. I had never thought of a life without her in it, never even thought of it as a possibility. A lot of girls go through their teenage years thinking their moms are against them. If there is one message that I would love to share with other kids going through this, it's to make sure your mom knows how much you love her, each and every day. Cancer definitely changes everything, but for me, it gave me a greater appreciation for everything my mom does for me. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Wilhelm. To find more stories like this, go to openorchardproductions.org.
To fight. There ain't nothing so sweet as a girl on skates whooping other girls' asses all night. She's the hottest little deal on hay wheels, burning like a babe out of hell. Jamming and a blocking and a little skull knocking, it's enough to make a grown man yell. Go, go, roller girl, look at that girl roll. Roller derby saved my soul.
From a choreographed show to a fast-paced sport, Emmett Pedersen has the story on the growing popularity of roller derby.
Makes me feel really tough. And I just love to hit people. It's really fun.
Alyssa Pulver, or as she is known on the derby track, the Pulverizer, has been skating for a Salt City Roller Derby in Syracuse, New York for 3 years.
I am a computer programmer, so I sit at a desk all day. Coming here is like, today work kind of sucked. So I'm like, well, at least I get to play and do something that I really enjoy.
The sport of roller derby began in the mid-30s and was more about entertainment than it was athleticism.
For the little ladies to start their merry round of riotous roller rough stuff that the fans go for. They say the men skate faster.
Drew Barrymore's 2009 film Whip It brought attention to the athleticism of the sport. Coach Razor, played by Andrew Wilson, explains the rules of the game.
Once the jammer breaks through the pack, she hauls ass around the track a second time and tries to score. For every player on the opposing team the jammer passes, she gets a point. Now line up and get you some.
Salt City is one of more than 350 derby teams recognized by the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, the international governing body of roller derby.
Our roller derby is real, strong, athletic, revolutionary. Our roller derby is WFTDA.
The women of Salt City not only skate for fun and exercise, but also to set the record straight.
I think there's an outside perception that it's not athletic when it is highly athletic. I think there's an outside perception that we're still pulling each other's hair and punching each other in the face when there isn't.
Erin McKnight skates and referees for local roller derby clubs in upstate New York. Since she joined the sport 3 years ago, she has seen it grow and become more serious as the years pass.
Roller derby fans are diehard fans because it's an underground community, so you're really involved in it. You really care about the players. People make signs. People cheer by name. People will drive hours to see their favorite player out on that court. Man, I love our fans. Our fans keep it alive.
The triangle is breaking itself up. If you have a jammer on two, the jammer wins every time.
Blair Genther, the coach of Salt City Derby, has been involved in the sport for 8 years and says derby has come a long way.
It's going legitimate, and I think that's the biggest change, is that it stopped being silly and started being something that's an alternative for girls and women that want to play a sport that involves some violence and speed.
Beyond local clubs, roller derby is growing both nationally and internationally. This year, the national championship was broadcast on ESPN for the first time, and the sport was considered as an add-in to the 2020 Olympic Games.
And it's competitive, and I feel like when you have women from around the world considering the different difficulties and challenges that they face in different countries and the different stigmas and the things associated, for everybody to be able to come together in such an empowering way.
Despite its national and international growth, McKnight finds one of the sport's biggest attractions to be its homegrown culture.
Roller derby leagues are not professionally owned and operated. They're skater owned and operated. So what you have is a group of people that this thing would not happen without that teacher, that nurse, that stay-at-home mom. And it's real people from your real community coming together.
From local clubs to ESPN, roller derby continues to grow with 66 apprentice league teams waiting to join the Women's Flat Track Derby Association.
There aren't female contact sports like this. What do you expect a young girl to do that maybe isn't into field hockey or maybe doesn't want to play softball, but maybe she wants to lay somebody out? That's what roller derby does, is it gives her a place to be.
A place to be, where regular women from all walks of life can be soccer moms by day and roller derby stars by night. I'm Emma Peterson.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1406.